So this year, as most of you know, we're exploring transcendental dependent arising, which is the path that leads us from suffering to liberation. In February, we worked with faith. In March, with joy or pamoja. In April, we worked with rapture. And our topic this month is tranquility. But before I really focus on tranquility itself, I'd like to say a little bit about this path of transcendent dependent origination itself. So as we move farther along the path in our studies this year, I think it's worth remembering that, well, the qualities of mind it includes are really beautiful qualities that we can and should recognize and cultivate in our daily lives. It's also a kind of map or description of how our practice naturally unfolds over time and as our mindfulness and concentration deepen. And as Joseph Goldstein mentions in one of his talks, a framework like this is really helpful for us because we can use it to put our own individual experiences into a larger context, and then we can really understand how what we experience really fits in with the overall framework of the teachings and kind of see that, yeah, you know, this is working the way that the teachings say that it works. So for the last part of April, I had the good fortune to be able to be on retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California, and I feel like this was just a perfect opportunity to explore this path of transcendent dependent arising. In that retreat environment where we're in silence, we don't have to worry about all our everyday responsibilities, and we spend our time sitting and walking, mindfulness and concentration really have the opportunity to deepen. And when that happens, it's possible to really see the development of these mind states we've been talking about. And that can be a really wonderful thing because we know then, yeah, these are there. These are possible for me. And for me in my days on retreat, all those mind states were there that we've been exploring. Faith, joy, rapture, tranquility, they were all there. And it's not like they arose one following the other like clockwork, you know, perfectly the way the path outlines them. And it's not like they were there all the time. There was plenty of room for a little aversion to arise, a little restlessness and worry, a little boredom, and of course wanting for more of what was pleasant, less of what was unpleasant, or just for something different. Yeah, those came up too. But even so, those beautiful mind states of faith, joy, rapture, tranquility, those were all there, and I could recognize them and really get a strong sense of them. And as the retreat progressed, I could see too that these different mind states really just arose by themselves. I didn't need to do anything in particular to make them happen, except to show up and be as mindful as I was able to be. That takes a little effort, but not a huge effort, as our teacher said, a gentle and persevering effort. And recognizing this, I could see how this path really is a natural and lawful unfolding. And this was something our teachers emphasized too, that this path of awakening is a natural process. In fact, one of them even said that it's going to work on us whether we want it to or not if we show up to practice. So our job is just to be with whatever's arising as best we're able, and the Dhamma takes care of the rest. And I think, I feel from my own experience, and you might feel too, that when we start to see this in our own practice, this really strengthens our faith, gives us a sense that things actually are unfolding as they should be, whether in that particular moment it seems like that to us or not. And it's really inspiring, too, because it reminds us that freedom is possible, not only in small ways, but in a big way, and possible for all of us. So if you have the opportunity to go on retreat, whether it's a residential retreat or a weekend or a day long during this year when we're studying Transcendent Dependent Arising, I'd really encourage you to do that, because when you take that time, you're likely to learn a lot about this path and how your own experiences fit within it. So that's my little plug for retreat. Our topic today, though, is tranquility, so I'd like to get to that. Tranquility. It seems like this is often what people are looking for when they come to meditation. Just some calm, just some relief from the worry and agitation of our stressful world. In fact, I got the sense last month that someone preferred to skip over joy and rapture altogether and just go straight to tranquility. And this isn't really so hard to understand, since our, you know, need for it in this really disrupted world is so great. And also rapture can be kind of strange and unfamiliar, but tranquility is something we all have some sense of, at least. I keep thinking about that metaphor of the oasis, how rapture is the feeling you have when you're traveling across the desert and you're tired and you're thirsty and you see that oasis just a little ways in the distance. You know you can get there, and there's joy, excitement, anticipation, that sense that you're really on the right track. All this energy comes up, and all these kinds of feelings in themselves are really quite pleasant. But then when you actually get to that oasis, when you sit down in the shade, have a drink of cool water, that relief, that contentment, the excitement and anticipation are good, but this is even better. And so we might be drawn to tranquility because of that feeling, and because that's our idea of what meditation is supposed to be. And if we have a little more experience, just as we see in that metaphor of the oasis, we may also be drawn because we see the limits of rapture. Bhikkhu Bodhi describes this really well in his essay on Transcendent Dependent Arising. He says, well, the appearance of rapture indicates a definite advance in the work of concentration. Its coarser modes still contain an element of exuberance, which is in constant danger of slipping out of control and spilling over into unwholesome states of mind, dominated by restlessness and agitation. For rapture involves intense delight in the object that we're aware of, coupled with the anticipation of even greater delight to come. The experience of present delight can often be accompanied by an underlying worry that this pleasure will disappear, while the expectation of further delight can stimulate a subtle grasping at the future. And then he goes on to say that both states, the anxiety and the grasping, bring along a kind of excitation that really interferes with the stability and the continuity of mindfulness. So all that bliss and ecstasy and energy, as nice as it can be, after a while becomes more an obstruction than a help in really seeing clearly. And I can tell you for sure, this is true. I definitely experienced this when I was on retreat and rapture arose. If I could just stay present with the feelings and recognize and appreciate them as pleasant, well, that was fine. But it was so too easy to get into a state of wanting, or just to get lost in the pleasantness and drift off into la-la land. And then after a while, all that energy, it was just tiring. And what one of my teachers advised me to do was really be mindful as this was happening of everything that was going on. The pleasant feelings, all the components of those feelings in the body and the mind, and that slippery slope that we can follow from knowing pleasant to liking it to wanting it to, oh my, this is so good, I don't ever want it to end, you know. And so she really encouraged me to really notice it all and put it all into what she called the wood chipper of mindfulness, even when I didn't really want to do this and wanted to just be lost in the pleasant. And that really did help, because just staying with what was actually happening as best as I could helped to really deepen the concentration and the continuity of mindfulness. And after a while, things did calm down. And there was more a sense of calm and tranquility. And tranquility, as Joseph Goldstein says in his talk on this subject that Candace mentioned last week, plays a really important part in our liberation. It's a really important mind state. Joseph goes on to explain that this is because when tranquility is developed, desire is abandoned. And that statement really struck me. When tranquility is developed, desire is abandoned. And it's abandoned quite naturally. You kind of see those subtle desires associated with rapture kind of falling away. And when the mind is calm, when the mind is content with what is, it's not looking around for something better. And when it's not looking around for something better, it's not caught up in wanting. And this is really important too, because not only because we're not caught up in these hindrances, but because if we're not looking for something better, we might actually be able to pay attention to what's really there. And that's important too. And also, Joseph goes on to say in his talk that it's important because this calming can help us to release that tendency towards efforting that can so easily creep into our practice. And I think you all know that kind of feeling, trying so hard to be concentrated, trying so hard to be mindful, to make calm happen, to make insight happen, to get on to the next step in the path. But all that efforting and wanting to progress can actually be a barrier to any kind of progress on the path. Think of all that goes with that efforting, wanting something better, aversion to what's present, judgment of how our practice is going, comparing our practice with our ideas of what should be happening or what we think is happening to other people. Identification with what's going on in our mind, so we get caught up in the story of my practice and my lack of progress. Not so much freedom in that, but the development of tranquility helps us to leave that behind and to settle into the way it is. And then when the mind really just settles into the way it is, this is really onward leading to deeper concentration, more continuous mindfulness, and clearer seeing. So tranquility is a beautiful and wonderful and really important mind state. But it has its challenges too. You know, just as with rapture, there's a danger of attachment. And maybe for some people, there's even more danger of attachment to tranquility than to rapture, in part because maybe tranquility really fits into our ideas of what meditation should be like. We might really believe that our real goal in practice is to be peaceful and calm. And so when we start to feel that, we just want to hang on to it. Well, those are really wonderful mind states. They aren't the end of the path. True freedom is more than being calm. The calm is a good thing, a part of it, that leads onwards to deeper understanding. And another thing to be aware of is it's not just the energy of rapture that can get out of balance as we become calm and tranquil. Our energy can get out of balance here too. If we have too much tranquility and not enough energy, we can slip into a kind of dullness and delusional state where we're not really aware of what's going on. Sometimes this is called sinking mind, and it's kind of like sloth and torpor, but it isn't so much that we're really sleepy as we're inattentive. We get ourselves lost in this calm and its pleasantness, and we kind of zone out. So we need to keep a balance between tranquility and the more energetic factors like investigation and that sense of rapture as a delight in knowing. So we need to stay mindful even when there is calm and quiet. And that can be a bit of a challenge. We can also be challenged by the feeling that tranquility is boring, or the sense that nothing is happening. And this really can be a challenge because the mind, it just loves to have the sense that stuff is happening. When it's too quiet, we can feel uneasy because where are we in all that quiet? As long as there's something going on to be known, we have the sense that, we're there. We're the one who's knowing all of this. This keeps the self active, this sense of the known and the knower. Too much calm, too much quiet can make us feel a little bit uneasy. I know I've felt that. When it's too quiet, there's a sense of the mind just, looking around for something it can attach on to, something it can think about or know or observe. And of course, the mind can always come up with distractions. I remember one time when I was on retreat and everything was getting very calm, very tranquil, very quiet. And then all of a sudden, this Prince song just came blaring up in my mind out of nowhere. Blah! And wow, that was pretty disruptive, all right, to just get rid of that quiet. Disrupting that quiet that the mind somehow didn't quite feel ready for and was a little bit afraid of. And so it needed something to get away from it. So that's something to think about too. Now, this quality of tranquility will come up in meditation, in our daily practice, and on retreat, as I've been talking about. And we can cultivate it in our daily lives as well. In many ways, we might feel like this is an easier quality to cultivate in daily life than rapture, although I think this sense of joyful interest that's a part of rapture is definitely something we can encourage. So in his talk on tranquility, Joseph Goldstein had several suggestions for encouraging tranquility. To notice if we become agitated. Notice when our mind is ahead of something, ahead of what's happening and in the future. Noticing when there's anticipation and excitability. And in all these situations, we can take steps to calm the mind a bit. Maybe just by pausing. By paying attention to the breath or the sensations of the body. So we can return from what we're thinking about in the future a little bit more to the present. And we can also practice composure and walking and other activities, like different things we're doing around the house, activities we do at work. He said that for him, when walking, it was helpful to say to himself, just walk. Just walk, or to use a similar reminder for other activities so the mind is really focused on the present and isn't rushing and isn't agitated and isn't waiting for the next thing. And you might have your own strategies for encouraging tranquility and calmness of the mind as you go about your daily activities. And I'd also like to mention that there's a tranquility that comes with deepening concentration and continuity of mindfulness. There's also tranquility that comes out of wisdom. The more we recognize that when we get caught up in our aversions, our cravings, our worrying about things that are beyond our control, this brings more suffering. It makes us more miserable and really doesn't help the situation at all. The more we see this, the less we get trapped in those states of mind, and the more calm and tranquil our minds will be. And this is something I think we can really notice and appreciate. As we continue to practice, often we notice that things that used to upset us a lot don't upset us as much now, and we don't stay upset as long. More of the time, the mind is in a state of, relative calm, relative ease, or what you might call tranquility. And this is something we might really appreciate and celebrate this month. So I'd like to close now with the words of the Japanese monk and poet Ryokan that say something about contentment and tranquility. He says, "I don't regard my life as insufficient. Inside the brushwood gate, there is a moon. There are flowers." So, thank you all for your kind attention. I really appreciate you being here, listening. And now we have some time for you to talk with each other about your own experiences of tranquility. As I said before, since we had the larger group discussion last week, I'm going to have some time for small groups this week. So we have a bit of both. Those who like small groups get some of their time. Those that like big groups get some of their time. So you'll have about 15 minutes to talk with each other, and then we'll return to the larger group. And during this time, I'd encourage you to share your own experiences of tranquility, either what you experience in retreat, in your daily practice, in daily life, whatever. What does tranquility mean to you in your practice? And of course, remembering our guidelines for discussion, letting everybody have a chance to speak without interruption, listening with your full attention as much as you're able, avoid giving unsolicited advice, speaking with kindness. So enjoy your conversation. Hi, welcome back, everybody. Great to see you returning to the big room. And so now we have some time for you to share whatever you would like to share. Maybe talk about some of the things you discussed in your groups. Or if you have any questions or comments, you're free to ask or say whatever you would like. It's always helpful to put up your virtual hand, but since everybody is on one screen right now, I think putting up your actual hand probably will also work too. So either way, if you have trouble finding your virtual hand, you can put up your actual hand. So the floor is open for comments, for sharing. Yes, Suze.
As always, it was such a good group, and people have so much wisdom. And I just am picking out one of the little choice moments where one of the people talked about being able to choose to let go of, as we discussed it, let go of the obstacles to tranquility, of the expectations and the staying stressed and keeping a particular perspective and stuff. And I feel like I've got some stuff to kind of cogitate on that one. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, it's so great when we notice that it's possible for us to do that.
And it wasn't so much choosing tranquility, but choosing to work with the things that stand in the way of it. And then if it's going to show up, allow it to show up. And that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, show up and just have a accepting attitude towards it. Yeah, thanks. That's that kind of wisdom really also encourages a sense of calm and tranquility. Karen, would you like to say something? I see that you're.
I'm sorry. I
Oh,
didn't
great.
like my battery was dying. But Tim, last year I had asked in a Tuesday meeting about when is the joy going to show up?
Oh,
Just because it was just when you're quiet and a lot of things arise, it's just sort of like, when's the joy going to show up? And the talk on joy and tranquility, of allowing tranquility and for joy to show up. He had just made this one suggestion because my job is really stressful, and that was some of the issue. And he was just like, just during the day, like, just take one moment and feel your feet on the ground. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, if I'm stressed with my patients and stuff, and it's just more, 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 and you got to go faster, 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 and you lose connection, and just stand in front of my computer or my cow is what they call them, and just feel your feet on the ground for 1 minute and take a breath in. And I'm just doing that all the time, and it just sort of like it arises this sense of calmness for just a moment that allows that break of intensity of allowing just a moment of tranquility to come in this month. It's just been really interesting that maybe it's just a minute of joyfulness, but it just opens the avenue to find joy in what I'm doing, to find joy in being with my patients, to just to find joy. Sometimes it comes in different ways, but it's just been this, it's taken months and months, but it's like just those moments of allowing it to come in and catching it when it's maybe I need to do it. It's just been this really kind of amazing thing.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much, Karen, for sharing that. And I really appreciate what you say about noticing that it shows up in moments.
Yes.
It's not necessarily always there, but it shows up in moments. And maybe the more you notice those moments,
Right.
the more of those moments there
Yes,
are.
it's the noticing. I think they were always there, but I didn't notice. They were always, like he said, they're there. You just, it's really quite, it's quite interesting. Months later, sometimes it takes months for stuff that you guys are teaching us to sink in.
Oh, that is so true. I know there's some stuff that I've heard about, and like years later will be, oh, now I understand what they were talking about. But thank you for sharing that. That's really inspiring, I think, for all of us, especially those of us who have a really stressful job like yours and can feel that it's just so hard to find. But you're saying, yeah, it is. Maybe just in moments, but it's there. So thank you. Wonderful. Thomas?
Yeah, thanks a lot for your talk, Lindell. There was a lot of great things there, very helpful. One thing I'm sort of puzzled by is the is talking about tranquility as sort of not wanting something to be different. You're just sort of feeling contentment with what you have. And that struck me. I think that is it's very inspiring. So a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, I think it's really rare. I got experienced that, but I'll start looking for it. And I'm sure it might be there and I have those moments. And the other part of it is like, if I'm thinking about how it impacts my choices. I mean, so much of my energy and time is focused on making things better, getting better equipment, getting better methods, getting better exercise, getting better food. I mean, better, better, better all over the place. And is that really needed? I mean, do I really need to do all this betterment, or is there these moments of enough? I mean, I think that is worth exploring, and that is a it started kind of it shatters my world a little bit because I'm so conditioned to looking for take action to make things better.
Aren't we all? I agree. I think that's really worth exploring. And what's kind of driving that better, 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 if it's really coming out of a sense of this is really going to benefit me and benefit others, or this kind of feeling like kind of perfectionism and I'm never quite good enough and all of those kinds of feelings.
And it's also, I think, I'm so used to things coming from the outside to me. That's where the contentment comes. And I think what this path is I feel there's a shift to what you realize a lot of that can come from inside as you do this practice. And wow, I mean, that is different.
Yeah, I think that is so true. And it, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't have things you would like to do or plans that you might make, but I think for me, what I've found is the sense of urgency to get those things, or that feeling of, oh, if I can just blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
not so much there, which is a relief. let's see, who was Jeremy? I think maybe you were the next. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, just to kind of add to that, I've been trying to figure out this like balanced approach to something similar, which is like I have this like incessant drive to like optimize things, whether it's like organizational stuff or like building tech stuff or whatever. And sometimes that's felt very like overwhelming. Like there's a lot of pressure and this like sense of like, oh, this needs to be perfect. But what I've found is there's also, it's also something that like I enjoy, like I like puzzles. I like solving things. And so it's been interesting to try and figure out a way to take that like natural, like urge that I have to like do all this crazy stuff, and actually find a sense of like, balanced appreciation for it, where I can simultaneously like, yes, not like put this sort of negative pressure on myself that if I don't do that, that it's bad, but also enjoy it when I am doing that. And like recognize that that's like a part of myself that I can, appreciate without the negative pressure, that like that positive for me personally, a lot of many of those sort of like incessant optimization tasks are, there is like some like enjoyment out of it that doesn't necessarily need to come with the negative.
So. Yeah, that is great. And that's a really, really good observation about how some of these things we do, there's a lot of joy in doing them. There's a lot of interest in doing them. And so if we can focus on that sense, rather than the sense of, oh, I got to do this, or there's something wrong with me, or I'm not good enough, or it has to be perfect. So that's great. And it sounds to me like you're really working well on finding a good balance. Thank you for sharing that. And now, Laura. Excuse me.
Okay, thank you. So I was thinking about identification and tranquility. And when I look out in the world, or I look at myself, I'm thinking, when I strongly identify, for example, with a political position, an ideological position, my tranquility just completely disappears. Right. So yet you look at the, and things are never black and white anyway. And, but we automatically assume that if somebody's taking the opposite position, right, then we think we spin all of our narratives. We also spin narratives about ourselves,
yeah,
and, you know, righteous and so forth. And so, and that's kind of what we're living right now. I want to say in our, just globally, right? So, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. So I'm not even going to name them. We all know what they are, right? But I think that we become so rigidified and so almost robotic that we've lost our humanity in just that softness, the flexibility, whatever it is. I just think that there's a definite correlation here between identification and tranquility. So I don't know. I'm thinking about that.
Yeah.
That's kind of come up for me. Yeah.
I think there is too. I think there is too, because the more we identify with our views or things we're doing, the more everything we think is a reflection on us. And so it all has to be just right so we can think of ourselves as, you know, good. And it just gets so wound up that there's no balance. So yes, very much that sense of identification is disruptive of tranquility. And it makes me think too how the Buddha really cautions us on holding too much to fixed views because that can disrupt things too. Okay, Dan, I think this can be the last one because it's almost our ending time. Please go ahead, Dan.
I've been struck as kind of new to this path about right effort. And we were talking in our small group about, you know, trying to find the discernment to say, where is the most valuable use of my effort? Is it to, am I too agitated and therefore making an effort to be tranquil would be sensible? And I like to think that we have some agency over these things. So I like to think there are things I can do to become more tranquil when I'm too agitated. I'd also like, I'll stop there. For me, the challenge continues to be where is the effort most valuable? But many, many years ago, I worked on a unit for anorexic kids. Mm-hmm. This was 50 years ago in training. And long story made short, one of the psychiatrists said to me, well, Dan, they have to first figure out if they're too thin or too fat. And it just struck me that 50 years later that you won't know what effort to make unless you have first done the discernment to say, am I too thin and starving myself is a disaster? Or am I too heavy and it really does make sense to lose some weight? So I don't want to get lost in that, but I feel like maybe I am a little lost at this point in saying, first the discernment of where is the effort best placed? And then I'm the kind of person who, like, sounds like many of you who are more than willing to make an effort, but I'd like it to be in furtherance of some objective that is worthy.
Well, discernment is a big, very important part of this. You know, discernment of understanding. And I think we all work with this. I mean, everybody, no matter how long you're practicing, working with this question of what really is wise effort in the moment is always a question. And of course, wise effort is cultivating the good and kind of abandoning the not so skillful, but how we do that is sometimes difficult to understand. I think when we're talking, and it can be different too, when we're talking about effort and what we're doing in our daily lives and effort in what we're doing when we're sitting on the cushion. Mm. When what we're sitting on the cushion, the wise effort may be more often to just recognize and be with what is instead of trying to change anything. Because that mindfulness itself is going to change what is there.
Mm-hmm.
Then thinking, oh, I got to get rid of this, I got to get more of this, doesn't always help. But sometimes you have to take a little different strategy out in the world where you're trying to find the wisest effort to, you know, have a good relationship with your family members or decide what to do in your work or other things like that. So I think you're not alone in trying to figure that out. Not a real definitive answer, but
I liked it a great deal.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think it's time for us to probably finish right now. So let's just take a few moments as we end to share the merit of our practice today. Maybe keeping in mind or bringing to mind people that we know that maybe aren't especially in need of support or kindness. Recognizing that as we come together to practice today, it really does create a force for good. Sharing that force for good with our loved ones, those in pain or suffering, and ultimately with all beings. May all beings find their own tranquility. Thanks, everybody, and have a wonderful day. And thanks for the great conversation we had once we got going. It was really nice.